Welcome back to The Europeans, the podcast about continental drama. That makes it sound a bit like a theatre podcast, doesn't it?
Yes, but there is a lot of drama on this continent.
How are you doing, Dominic? You've been very busy.
Yeah, it's true. I've been basically living in a theatre for the last 2 weeks.
This is a theatre podcast.
This is. Yeah, but I've been working really hard, but I have actually also been having fun. So I don't want people to feel too sorry for me. You should know that a lot of my work has just consisted of me rolling around on the floor, pretending to be a wolf puppy.
Okay.
Using my voice, trying to make bird noises.
Do you want to give us a taste of some of those bird noises?
I don't know what bird it is.
And they're paying you for this.
Yeah. Okay. Is it not good?
No, it's very beautiful.
Anyway, how have you been? What have you been up to, Katie?
No bird noises on my front. I'm good, thanks. I've just come back from lovely Rouen in Normandy, famously where Joan of Arc was burned at the stake. But apart from that, it's really nice. And it's the town where my parents met and fell in love many moons ago. So I went to meet up with them there and it was very nice.
Oh, that's nice. Was it an anniversary?
No, just a random weekend in February.
That's as good a reason as any.
It is. But bird noises and being burned at the stake aside, what are we talking about this week?
Well, last week you sent me a message saying, do you think it's too early in the year to talk about the Eurovision Song Contest? And I think we all know the answer to that, which is it's never too early to talk about Eurovision. Anyway, we're only 2 months away from the competition, so I can't believe you are even asking.
Only 2 months.
I mean, you could even argue that we're a bit late with beginning our coverage. So it was decided we're talking about Eurovision this week, but with a bit of a left field angle. We're going to be speaking to someone who created a podcast that is described as almost a Eurovision podcast, because it's a show that looks into the songs that almost made it to Eurovision but didn't quite get there. It's a pretty bonkers and joyful concept, which will be explained later on in the show by Monty, the very charming co-host of the Second Cherry podcast. But first, it's time for
Who has had a good week, Dominic?
It's been a good week for Ellie Schlein, a left winger who defied expectations and won the primary to become leader of Italy's Democratic Party this week. And it was a really surprising result. She had lost by a wide margin at the party members' caucus last week to the politician who had the backing of the party establishment, a guy called Stefano Bonaccini. However, in this weekend's vote, it was an open primary, meaning that people could vote even if they weren't party members. And she scooped up a ton of votes, especially from young people and left-wingers, who are hoping that the Democratic Party can start a fight back from opposition after years of the Italian left becoming more and more splintered whilst the far right has grown in popularity.
This means that both the main opposition party and the governing party in Italy are led by women. Is this the first time that's ever happened in Italy?
Yes, it is definitely the first time that's ever happened. And Schlein is actually the first female leader of Italy's main social democratic party, who are the largest opposition party in Italy's parliament and a party that has long been led by middle-aged men. She's also the first LGBTQ plus leader of the party. She came out as bisexual a few years ago. And at 37, she's also the youngest ever leader of that party and almost certainly the most progressive. She immediately promised to cause problems for the ruling right-wing government, which is indeed also led by a woman, Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni, leader of the Brothers of Italy party, a party with neo-fascist roots. Forgive me for repeating that on this show again, but I feel it's important to mention it every time we talk about her.
That's a lot of firsts for one person. But what's her kind of background? What kind of a political journey has she been on?
Well, she says that she learned a lot in her 20s whilst volunteering for Barack Obama's two presidential campaigns in 2008 and 2012. She's actually got triple citizenship. She's Italian, American, and Swiss because she was actually born in Switzerland.
Glam.
She went on to be elected as a member of the European Parliament for the Italian Democratic Party in 2014, but quit the party that she's now leading in 2015 because she was so frustrated with the direction that the party was going in under Matteo Renzi. In the intervening years, she was members of three different left-wing political parties, There's a lot of them in Italy, and only rejoined the Democratic Party last year. Since 2020, she has been vice president of the region of Emilia-Romagna, ironically with her boss, the president of Emilia-Romagna, being the guy she just beat in the leadership election just last weekend.
That's going to make for some awkward meetings.
Right. But yeah, she's very experienced both on the regional and the European level, and now has been given a huge job on the national stage as de facto leader of the opposition.
And you said she's a left winger. But in policy terms, in Italy, what does that mean? What does it look like?
Yeah, well, she's definitely on the left wing of a party that has recently been rather closer towards the centre. But she believes that the way to beat the far right is with a platform that is progressive, environmentalist and feminist. That means that she wants to improve working conditions and defeat poverty. She argues for bringing in a minimum wage. Yes, Italy still doesn't have one. She wants to improve the precariousness of freelance work. She's also a supporter of the four-day week. She will fight privatization of healthcare, and LGBTQ plus rights are also very important to her. She backs gay marriage, for example. I'm a bit conflicted about mentioning this because I don't know how useful all these Anglophone political comparisons are that I'm seeing in the international media, but she is often compared to other famous left-wing politicians who have built successful grassroots campaigns. Can you guess who?
Well, I mean, I haven't done as much background reading as you have, obviously, but I've seen her compared to two people already. One of them is AOC and the other one is Corbyn.
Yeah. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is someone she's often compared to Italy's AOC, but I'm not sure it's such a great comparison. I think she's just compared to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez because she's got like relatively similar politics to her and is a young woman who can speak well. But I think other than that, they've got quite a lot of differences because Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez wasn't like a career politician, whereas she actually is. She's also being compared a lot to, or at least this moment is being compared to the time when Jeremy Corbyn shook up the establishment and was elected leader of the British Labour Party. Again, yeah, she's very different to Corbyn in lots of different ways. On the other hand, I understand why people want to make these connections and comparisons to kind of contextualize her. But I do think she's going to have quite a different time. And it's a very different context, obviously.
I did see someone on Twitter saying that she has slightly controversial views on Ukraine. Is that actually the case, though? This was like one tweet that I saw.
Yeah, some people do seem to be nervous about her views on Ukraine. And it's actually worth mentioning that one side of her family actually descend from a village near modern-day Lviv that was at the time part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. But she does have a personal connection to that area, and she is clearly very strong in her condemnation of Putin and Russia. We should be very clear about that. But she is also a pacifist, and she said the following in a recent interview with the Italian broadcaster LA7. She said, "We support Ukraine's right to defend itself through every form of assistance. But as a pacifist, I don't think that weapons alone will end the war." I don't know if that means she doesn't think Italy should be arming Ukraine. It seems like a bit of an ambiguous quote to me. But I think it's because of this that some analysts seem nervous that she might end up adopting a policy against arming Ukraine along the lines of that of the anti-establishment left-wing party in Italy, the Five Star Movement. Maybe she should listen to our episode from last week to hear one young Ukrainian's view on this issue. Valeria, the subject of last week's episode, is really sharp on this. And she said something along the lines of, "I wish we here in Ukraine could have the privilege to believe in not using lethal weapons." But anyway, we'll have to wait and see how that policy area develops and how successful she is in revitalizing the Democratic Party brand in general. But there is clearly a lot of excitement about her amongst many people, and the Democratic Party is certainly going to change, which seems like it's at least worth a try, considering the party's support has been waning and the party brand has become a bit stale thanks to its association with various crisis hit compromising governments. The party certainly for now has a leader who is standing for something different. And yeah, I'm interested to see how that goes.
Yeah, one thing I'm really interested to see is whether Elie Schlein could prove like a slightly more unifying figure for the left in Italy. Like we talked just after the elections. I remember that interview we did with Lorenzo Marsili about how like he really felt the left's failure to provide like a decent united front against the right was one of the major factors that allowed Giorgia Meloni to win in the first place. And I am intrigued to see whether she can be a more unifying figure. I mean, she would be considered still very left-wing by some of the more centrist people, right? And I'm just wondering if we're going to have the same problem all over again or not.
Yeah, well, she's been a member of many, many different left-wing parties, so hopefully she can be a bridge maker.
Friends in many places.
Before I wrap this up, I didn't feel like I could talk about Italy this week without acknowledging the absolutely horrific news that started to emerge this weekend of a boat carrying over 200 people trying to get to Italy, sinking off the southern coast with at least 100 dead at the time of recording. It's absolutely horrible news and just yet another tragedy that makes it seem like the Mediterranean is turning into a mass grave for the tens of thousands of people who have drowned in it in the last 10 years. And in fact, Elie Schlein commented on this tragedy when she was going to cast her vote in the primary. She said to some journalists that the disaster was on the conscience of the Italian government after approving a decree that impedes sea rescues. And she's referring there to a tough new bill that came in just a few days ago that makes it even harder for boats to rescue people at sea off the coast of Italy. Giorgia Meloni argues that stopping search and rescue boats by NGOs deters people from making the crossings in the first place. But yeah, almost all of the experts I read on this suggest that policies like this new one from Meloni are not working as a deterrent. I saw the UN human rights chief recently said that Italy's policies could put more lives at risk. So a good week for Schlein, but a really tragic week in the Mediterranean.
Absolutely.
Who has had a bad week?
We are going to Malta for bad week. I'm giving bad week to the Maltese courts and the prison service because of a rather eyebrow-raising decision to briefly let a man called George DiGiorgio out of prison so that he could go to a party. Who is DiGiorgio? He is one of the men serving a long jail sentence for killing Daphne Caruana Galizia. Daphne was a very famous Maltese investigative journalist who made it her life's mission to root out corruption on the island. And she paid the ultimate price for her work. She was brutally murdered in 2017 in a car bombing. And as many of you will remember, Daphne's killing sent shockwaves across Malta and all across Europe. The case received a lot of international attention, not just for the sheer brutality of Daphne's killing, but for the spotlight that it cast on the murkiness of Maltese politics, not least in the way that the investigation was handled. Justice proceeded very, very slowly, with plenty of allegations along the way that powerful people in Malta had a vested interest in trying to keep what happened shrouded in doubts and ambiguities. But there's now three people serving jail time for Daphne's murder. One accomplice who's serving 15 years, and these two brothers, George and Alfred DiGiorgio. They were sentenced last October to 40 years each. Both of them had pleaded guilty to serving as the hitmen in the killing. And although they've both demanded a retrial, they're both now behind bars. However, it turns out that the weekend before last, one of the brothers, George, was allowed out of prison for the evening so that he could go to the baptism of one of his grandchildren and the party afterwards. That's nice, isn't it?
Is that like a regular occurrence to let jailed people out for a party?
Well, it turns out it actually is a thing in Malta. It's quite an interesting policy. You are sometimes allowed out of prison in Malta on compassionate grounds to attend important family events like funerals, perhaps weddings, in this case, a baptism. And these little outings tend to be linked to good behavior. So I guess it kind of works as an incentive scheme. And Malta is far from the only country that does this. Lots of countries have some kind of scheme that allows inmates out briefly for important family events, especially funerals. This is done in countries ranging from Greece to the US.
I understand it more for funerals than like weddings because...
Weddings are fun.
Weddings are fun and funerals are not.
Well, this is a baptism. I guess you could argue it's a religious thing, a Catholic thing.
And it's Malta.
In Malta, though, if you are in prison but you're facing prosecution for another case that's still ongoing, these little outings are supposed to be really strictly controlled. Because, you know, say you've been allowed out to go to this funeral or wedding or whatever, and then you happen to have a conversation at this event with someone that you're really not supposed to be talking to, like a witness in the case, that really wouldn't be ideal, right?
Mm.
And in this case, in the case of George DiGiorgio, he is facing prosecution in another case, another murder case. And yet there are photos of him hanging out and smiling with a big group of people at this family baptism. So it seems really surprising that A, he was allowed out in the first place, given that this party was a good opportunity for him to potentially speak to people that he really shouldn't. But B, if he was allowed out, then you wouldn't expect him to just be able to mingle freely at this event. Apparently he was there with some kind of chaperone, but it's not really clear how heavily supervised he was. And the guest list of this party was interesting. The Times of Malta, which broke the story, they reported that at least one person suspected of being heavily involved with the organized crime scene in Malta was at this baptism, but they didn't name him.
So who is responsible for this decision to let him out?
Well, apparently Malta's attorney general was very against him being allowed out of prison. But in spite of that, there were two court decrees confirming that he would be allowed out. Mm. And the prison director was also apparently okay with it. But the truly interesting thing is that on Sunday, DiGiorgio's son was arrested. And he was arrested because someone had written a Facebook post about the fact that his dad was allowed out of prison to go to this party. And then the son, this guy called Denzel, he had replied to this Facebook comment saying simply, "Money talks." Interpret that how you will. Apparently Denzel realized quite soon after he posted this that it maybe looked a bit like a suggestion that his dad might have bribed someone to let him out of prison. And so Denzel deleted the message soon afterwards. But it was too late. It got screenshotted and Denzel was swiftly arrested by financial crime investigators.
Whoa.
But we don't really know for sure whether or not any money changed hands to allow DiGiorgio out of prison.
It must also be pretty upsetting for Daphne's family to see this man that killed their mother, like, hanging out at a party.
Yeah, absolutely. And they said as much. The family released a statement saying, security risks aside, it's shockingly disrespectful to his victim. Mm-hmm. And you have to remember that this is a man who did not strike a particularly remorseful tone when he admitted to killing Daphne. He actually admitted to the murder for the first time on a podcast. And the way that he talked about it, he said he felt sorry, but that taking the contract to kill her was just business as usual. And he even came across as greedy about taking on this assassination. He said that if he'd known how big a target Daphne was, he would have asked for 10 million euros instead of 150,000. DiGiorgio is thought to be still maintaining certain contacts with gang members. And if he was allowed out for his grandchild's baptism, because he has influential friends who managed to exert some kind of pressure with money or with other means, it doesn't really send a convincing message that much has changed since Daphne died, and died while reporting on Malta's corruption problems.
And has much changed since Daphne died?
Well, one of the main things that was achieved after Daphne's murder is that her family and other campaigners, including NGOs and even EU institutions, they managed to get a public inquiry launched in Malta into the killing. And that was really important because the criminal investigation into who killed her was really mostly about trying to pinpoint individuals that might be jailable for it. It wasn't about trying to identify these wider problems in Maltese society and politics, endemic corruption, institutional failures, the lack of independence of the court system. All of these factors had contributed to Daphne's death in the wider sense by creating this culture of impunity where it felt like you could literally get away with murder in Malta. So Daphne's family and others, they fought tooth and nail for 2 years for this wider public inquiry to happen. And it did happen, and it felt like a big deal. This kind of inquiry is super rare in Malta. And Daphne was, in fact, the first murdered journalist anywhere in the world to have their death looked at in this kind of public inquiry. And the retired and serving judges who were in charge of it, they ended up concluding that the state was responsible for Daphne's death in helping to create an environment where it was so incredibly dangerous for an anti-corruption journalist to do their work and in failing to protect her. The report also said a lot of other damning stuff about the state of politics in Malta and how easy it is to get away with corruption. And they suggested a bunch of reforms to better protect journalists and to make the government more transparent. That report was published in 2021. And nothing much has happened since. Maltese journalists still say they are facing a really hostile environment. And the government doesn't really seem to be that enthusiastic about making any of these reforms happen. And there's still a bunch of questions over who was really responsible for Daphne's death. I mean, fine, the hitmen who planted the car bomb itself are in prison. What about who ordered it? There is this Maltese casino boss called Jürgen Fenech, who has a lot of close links to politicians, interestingly. He is suspected of a role in planning the murder. He was among the many, many people that Daphne had exposed as having questionable financial dealings. Fenech is still awaiting trial, but his team have been doing a lot to delay that process. They tried, for example, to get a judge kicked off the case, and that took up time. So it's slow. It's very, very slow. And I have to say, I have so much admiration for Daphne's family and the campaign for trying to get justice for her, because I think a lot of people would have given up a long time ago, but they're still fighting for it to happen.
We haven't done any Patreon shout-outs for a few weeks, so we have a nice long list of wonderful people to thank for helping this show survive. Thank you to Irina Katz, Margot Peinenberg, Roxana Chatin, Alex, Ioana Lungu, Salvo Candela, Chris Doxy, Daphne Giacero, Philip Kitzberger, Luke Watts, and Lisa Lang for increasing her pledge.
That sounds like a really long list of people, which might make it sound like we're doing great and everything's fine. And everything is great. And we love making this podcast and we've been really happy to see it grow over time and for more people to discover it. But it does take four people to make The Europeans, and that costs money. We still don't actually have enough money to make everything that we want to make this year. So if you would like to help us ensure that The Europeans stays in your ears for the rest of 2023, we would be incredibly grateful if you could consider supporting us. You can chip in as little as $2 a month in many currencies at patreon.com/Europeans podcast. Tis the season. Eurovision is upon us, Dominic. You might think that I'm mad for saying that because the grand final, you know, the big night with millions of people tuning in to watch it live on television across the continent, that big night is not until May. But we are actually in the midst of loads of countries' contestants being announced. The songs that will be vying for Eurovision glory are trickling in. So we're starting to get an idea of how the competition is shaping up. And you've been getting quite into this early stage of the Eurovision process, haven't you?
Well, I think maybe that's overstating it a bit. I have been more aware of it this year because it's somehow, I realize I'm following loads of fellow Eurovision nerds on Twitter. So I'm like aware that it's happening. But I think if I was like to properly follow it, then it would take over my life. And I think it's good that I don't do that.
You're not there yet. I don't think I'm quite ready for that level of Eurovision nerdery either. I do love Eurovision, but I don't tend to get properly invested until the big night with all the razzmatazz. Someone who is much, much more invested than you and me, truly a Eurovision expert, is this week's guest, Monty Moncrief, the co-host of Second Cherry, a podcast about all of these songs that were in the running to be their national entries on Eurovision, but didn't make it, sadly, to the final. If you are a true Eurovision nerd, you're going to love this interview. If you're someone who hates Eurovision and you're about to switch off, don't do it, because this interview is joyous and it will improve your day. Is it a silly thing to be talking about this week? Yes, yes it is. But you know what? The news has been extra miserable recently. So we thought everyone could do with some cheering up this week. So please enjoy a great chat with Monty Moncrief about all the songs that so nearly make it to Eurovision. Why, of all topics, would you want to make a podcast about the songs that were in the running to appear on Eurovision, but never even made it to the competition?
Well, I mean, it is super geeky, isn't it? It's kind of squeezing every last drop out of Eurovision that we can get. I mean, in the early 2000s, it became much easier to tune in to all of the various competitions that were happening around Europe that were selecting songs, because they began being streamed online. And so we started watching, and then we started getting frustrated at the really good songs that didn't quite make it. And you want to kind of give them a second chance. So Second Cherry is about giving a second bite of the cherry. We decided to put them together initially, not as a podcast. Initially, this was a house party where we put together a selection of songs, invited friends around, and we had a vote. It became very popular within a couple of years, so we were already taking it into a pub, hiring a venue to have this event every year. And then we did 10 years of it between 2006 and 2015. We just felt we needed a little break. But then in 2019, we revived it with the podcast attached. It just felt like it was a really good format for a podcast to look at a different country's national final each week and pick a song that we thought deserved a second chance. And we still have the live event at the end of the season as well.
Honestly, I cannot imagine how you keep on top of all these national contests each year. It must be a bit like a full-time job, because around this time of year, there are, for people that don't know, there are like multiple national selection contests every weekend. And we've just had this Super Saturday, right, where there are seven countries choosing their songs through televised contests all in one weekend. How do you manage to follow them all?
Well, it is a little bit like a full-time job. And when you get something like Super Saturday, where you've got seven or eight shows going on at once, it's impossible. I do know some people who multi-screen. You know, they're watching sort of three or four songs at once.
Oh my God.
Sounds insane.
I can't do that. I have to keep my focus on just the one. But it is a frenzy of making notes so we can refer back to them after the contest, which is when we really select the songs. But it's hard work. I mean, sometimes I look and we see competitions that have like four heats, then three semi-finals, then second chance round, and then a final. And you just think, oh, good grief. I mean, how am I going to get through all of those songs? San Marino is choosing at the moment. They're just at the end of a week of 106 songs in their heats.
For such a tiny country.
I know, it's crazy. It's just totally disproportionate. So I think on that one, we're probably just going to go with what's in the final. But it is a really interesting way of just keeping up with some new music and some new artists. And of course, we spot artists who maybe don't win the first time they have a go, but then come back and have a go a few years later, and then go on to Eurovision and, you know, go on to huge Eurovision success. Artists like Conchita Wurst, for example, we had her as the second cherry entry for Austria in 2012, I think it was, with a song that she'd had in the Austrian final. But of course, 2 years later, she gets to Eurovision and wins the whole thing.
Can you tell us a little bit about how the selection process works in different countries? Is it different in different places?
Yes, it is. Each country is free to choose their entry in whichever way they see fit. Some will have enormous selection shows, which are part of the cultural calendar. Sweden, for example, has a show called Melodifestivalen, which has been going since the 50s. It's now a six-week process of four heats, a semi-final and a final. But it also has a place in the sort of the music economy. You know, lots of artists will time their Melodifestivalen entry to be the lead single from a new album that's coming out, because it generates quite a lot of chart hits there. But other countries just pick a song and say, this is going to be our song. The UK, for example, where I'm based, we've gone through different processes. Last year, we selected an artist internally, but we've had many years where we've had competitions variously called things like a Song for Europe or the Great British Song Contest. And that's been how our entry has been selected. We're going for an internal selection again this year. And at the point that we're recording this, we still don't know who that's going to be.
So let's talk about this year's entries. Not every country has confirmed their selection yet, but from the contests that have taken place already, which songs are you already thinking, oh man, it is such a tragedy that this song hasn't made it into the contest? It is a banger.
The shows I've seen, the Italian selection, which is the Sanremo Festival, which has been going on for longer than Eurovision, that's thrown up some really beautiful songs. We still don't know if the song that won is actually going to go to Eurovision, because the artist has the prerogative to change their mind and take a different song. The Swedish selection is going on, and probably the biggest Eurovision winner of the last 10 years or so, Lorraine, is back, who won with Euphoria in 2012. She's back in the Swedish competition, and everybody has high expectations that she will win. So if not, she might be a possibility for us to select for second cherry. But we're right in the middle of the season, where we're kind of surrounded by songs that are coming around, and, you know, we're thinking, well, this might be a good song, but we're still waiting to see whether it's eligible for second cherry by virtue of it not winning its own national final.
And do you only celebrate the best of the rest, so the people that deserve a second cherry, or do you also look at the kind of worst Eurovision, almost Eurovision songs? Because that's part of the joy of Eurovision, right? The kind of silly side.
It absolutely is. I think our criteria is the most noteworthy song, which is a very generous adjective. I think we are looking to celebrate some of the things that are just pure ridiculousness on stage. You know, and if something is ridiculous, you know, let's call it ridiculous, but, you know, let's celebrate the nonsense. We've had some of those in Second Cherry over the years. We've seen many at Eurovision as well.
It's very true. Today, when I told my husband I was doing this interview today, he made me watch a video from the selection process in the Netherlands in 99 or 98. And it's identical twins who are called Double Date, and they're singing a song called Email to Berlin. And it's famous in the Netherlands for being the worst performance of anything on national television. It's these poor, poor women standing up there singing completely out of tune with terrible lyrics, awful music, with a weird like Hebrew bit in the middle that seems completely irrelevant to the song. But it's just, it's so joyful, and I was so happy to discover it.
And you will find a link to that in the show notes, because I need to watch this right now, and so does everyone else.
Do you know it?
I do know it, yes. I watched the video of it not that long ago, actually. Yeah, I mean, it's completely delightful. For all the wrong reasons.
Absolutely. They're national treasures. It's fun.
And now we're making them international treasures with Second Cherry.
Absolutely.
I mean, some artists do keep trying for Eurovision year after year, even if they keep being rejected. Are there any of these artists who have almost made it multiple times and never have, and who you feel really do actually deserve that chance on the main stage?
Oh, yes. I mean, you know, you look at Sweden, you look at Italy, you look at Norway, some of the Baltic states that have very, very long-standing competitions, and you get perennial triers, some of which are good, but then some of them you kind of think, how did you get in this competition again? There's a guy in the Moldovan selection with some very, very questionable songs. He had a song in last year's competition called I Just Had Sex With Your Ex. And there's a lot more questionable lyrics in some of his songs. And bless him, you just think, how on earth do you get into this competition? Is there no quality filter applied at all? But yeah, I mean, some of the artists, I mean, if you look at Sweden, I think there are some artists we see in Melody Festival, and as fanboys of the show, we absolutely love and cherish them because they sing completely old-fashioned songs that we love. But you think, actually, your career only exists in something like Melody Festival, and you've never really broken out of that onto the international platform. But of course, these local festivals or local competitions, you know, by getting your song a showcase on this TV show, it can be a springboard to that song being a hit for you.
You can find Second Cherry on whatever app you're listening to this on, and also at the link in the show notes. Monty and his co-host Matt have a few bonus episodes lined up in the coming weeks in the run-up to the Eurovision final on May the 13th. But of course, their podcast isn't really about the big Eurovision night at all. So they will have a new season starting in June, running through to the autumn, giving some love to all of those nearly Eurovision hits that still deserve our love and attention. And they'll be doing a live recorded final episode for their season in London in October. I also wanted to give a shout out to our longtime listener, Adrian Murphy, for suggesting this interview. We love it when people suggest guests. It means less work for us. So if you've got an idea for someone that other people would enjoy hearing on the Europeans, drop us an email, hello@europeanspodcast.com.
Time for an advert.
Imagine if someone promised to double your money within a year by investing in medical cannabis.
Would you believe it?
This is the story of the biggest cannabis scam ever.
This is the story of Juicy Fields.
And the scam might just go on.
This is Cannabis Cowboys.
The story about big dreams,
juicy money,
and never-ending hype.
Find Cannabis Cowboys wherever you get your podcasts.
What have you been enjoying this week?
I'm afraid I'm sticking with Eurovision for Isolation Inspiration. Yeah, because I said I haven't really been following the national contest, but there is one that I kind of peeked in on because Monty mentioned that Loreen, who won Eurovision 11 years ago, was back competing for Sweden's place in the competition. And I couldn't help but look into it. Her performance on the Melody Festival was actually quite dramatic because it was interrupted by a stage invasion from a climate protester. And she had to stop and then restart her performance. She later referred to the activist in an interview with ECS Extra as her beautiful little activist.
Oh, that's sort of sweet but demeaning at the same time.
Yeah. No, well, wait. She then went on to say that she didn't feel any hostile energy whatsoever.
Oh.
And that she didn't mind that it happened, acknowledging that activists are doing really important work. So I actually thought it was quite a nice reaction and made me like her even more than I already do, and gave me just another excuse to talk about her here in Isolation Inspiration and remind you all that Euphoria is just one of the best Eurovision songs of all time. So go listen to that and also check out her new song, Tattoo, which honestly I don't think is as good as Euphoria. And I don't think it's going to win, even though I've not heard any of the other songs. But I just don't think it's good enough. But it probably will still nonetheless be played in gay clubs around the world every weekend for the next 25 years. So get used to it.
Yay!
What have you been enjoying, Katie?
I got stuck into a very enjoyable podcast called The Last Soviet. Have you heard of it?
No.
So it's about the Russian cosmonaut Sergei Krikalev and the absolutely crazy decision that he was faced with in 1991, just as the Soviet Union was falling apart. Basically, the Soviet Space Agency called him and they were like, look, everything is in chaos down here on the ground. The space program is collapsing. The country is collapsing. We cannot pay for any of the space stuff anymore. What do you want to do? Do you want to come back now in the escape shuttle? If you do that, you can see your wife and your baby. But it means the end of your mission. And we can't tell you what's going to happen to your mission or to the Mir space station that you have devoted yourself to. And the podcast, no spoilers, is about what Krikalev decided to do next. But it's also kind of a potted history of the space race during the Cold War in general. And it's told at quite a leisurely pace. The first episode isn't really about this decision at all. It's about the early days of the Soviet space operation. The team behind the podcast were apparently supposed to go to Moscow to interview Krikalev for the podcast. They were planning to go in February 2022, but that didn't happen for obvious reasons. But it's a fascinating podcast nonetheless. And one of the things that I love about it, you will never guess who is hosting this show. Never in a million years.
Oh, now I really want to guess.
Give it a go.
Jean-Claude Juncker.
It's not Jean-Claude Juncker, but I do also want to hear that alternative edit. Somebody make that happen. No, it's not Jean-Claude Juncker. Do you remember NSYNC, the 90s boy band?
Of course I do.
Did you know that Lance Bass from NSYNC trained as a Russian cosmonaut?
No.
It's true. That's what he did at the turn of the millennium. The guy just loves space. I don't know what to tell you.
Whoa.
That adds like a really pleasingly random element to a show that was already very enjoyable. So I really recommend it. It is called The Last Soviet.
My happy ending this week comes from a pretty unlikely source, a piece of academic research from the Antiquity Journal.
Sounds dusty.
The paper is re-examining an object found in a ditch at the Vindolanda Roman Fort in northern England. It was found back in the 1990s. And it had initially been catalogued as a darning tool. But these two archaeologists, both called Rob Collins and Rob Sands, have published a paper that suggests that whoever had initially catalogued this item may have been a bit of a prude, because it's pretty clear that this wooden object is no darning tool. It's a wooden phallus.
Oh.
And if any of our non-native English speakers out there don't know what that word is, phallus is basically a posh word for penis.
It's a wooden penis.
And it's big news because it's the first phallic object of its type found from the Roman era. Obviously, there's lots of phalluses on statues in Roman art, but what's unusual about this phallus is that it's disembodied.
Mm.
Which brings up the exciting question of what was this 6.5-inch long wooden penis used for?
Oh, I see. It's not a statue. So why else would you want a wooden
penis to wave around?
It could be for waving around.
Well, the authors of this paper give us three possibilities. It could be part of a larger object. So a penis that was inserted into and out of another statue.
What?
There are apparently other examples of Roman statues with removable penises.
Really?
Second possibility is that it could have been a pestle from a pestle and mortar. So a penis-shaped object to grind up your food. Very useful.
I quite like that idea. That's a great novelty gift from the Roman times.
I bet you can still get one on AliExpress. But the third and frankly most exciting possibility is that it was a dildo. If that is the case, it would be a groundbreaking discovery because up until now, there have been no dildos found from the Greco-Roman era. Although there have been dildos referenced in art from that time, so historians believe they did exist.
I can't believe you just said that sentence.
One of the most incredible arguments about all of this is that the two Robs, they did loads of really careful analysis on this wooden phallus, and they established that there are two areas on the phallus where the wood has worn down due to repetitive friction.
Ew!
Final and favourite tidbit about this possible Roman dildo is that it was probably a bit bigger than it is now. Because wood shrinks.
It's been whittled away by use.
No, not whittled away. That would be horrible.
This is maybe the most horrible happy ending you've ever done. But it is very much a happy ending.
It is. Finally, the segment lives up to its double entendre potential. But hey, go make up your own mind whether it's a dildo or not and visit the Vinderlander Museum in Hexham in the UK where it's on display. Thank you so much to everyone who listened to last week's episode, Valeria. We're super proud of the work that Valeria and Katz and the whole team did on this piece. And we're really touched to see that it seemed to be helping people process a pretty horrible anniversary, the 1-year anniversary of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Please do get in touch with your feelings about that episode or about this one. It really does mean a lot to us when we hear from you. And we can't always get back to everyone, but we do read all the feedback, both good and bad. And we try and take it into consideration. So you can get in touch with us on Twitter at EuropeansPod, Instagram at EuropeansPodcast, or email us at hello@EuropeansPodcast.com.
The show was produced this week by me and Wojciech Oleksiak. Our other producer, Katz Laszlo, is off working on some exciting things for later in the year.
We'll be back next week with more stories from Europe to stuff into your beautiful ears. Till then, bye.
So unpleasant. Bye, everyone.